What's up? Welcome back, everybody, to the show. It does have a name now. Sorry to let you guys down, but we had to get 1% more professional. So welcome back to the Bitcoin Weekly Kickback with same people, four dudes chatting about Bitcoin things. And so a lot happened in the past 7 to 10-ish days. Lots of good. The halving, runes, Epic Sat, miners getting paid. But bad stuff, too. The U.S. is going after aggressively privacy tools, and it's already causing other providers of, say, Lightning non-custodial tools to jump out of the U.S. to proactively not be targeted. So, ton to talk about. But first, one thing that we talked about previously is there going to be a crazy hyped halving block? Are the miners going to do things that, like, a three-depth reorg, my understanding, is, like, incredibly rare. It never happens. And some people out there were like, there's going to be a five-block reorg. They're quite, like, crazy because there's so much value locked. And that didn't happen at all. They didn't. They just sat on their hands, and whoever won the block won the block. I don't know. Do we have bets on that? I can't remember who saw what.
We had predictions.
Yes, we had bets.
We had bets. I know I lost. Bob won.
Yep. Everybody thought it was going to be crazy. In fact, it was like a hyped narrative going in, like, oh, the reorg, who's going to try to get the first block? My prediction was no reorgs, because it just made sense.
Yeah, I think one of the things, and I'd been talking about this a lot, where I, you know, limited the scope of analysis of predicting the reorg to what if it were just the first block or two after the halving that were the big valuable block. But what we saw was that the entire, like, next 100 to 200 blocks were all unbelievably valuable. So it actually, you know, in retrospect, perhaps didn't make as much, you know, sense to try to reorg just one block, which is a 37 fee Bitcoin block, and maybe rather be like, okay, well, we're just going to pocket the extra 20 Bitcoin fee per block for the next, like, 10, 20, 30 blocks. So, obviously can't analyze everything in a vacuum, but Bob wins this one. No reorg.
We get some animation, you know, Bob won, everyone else zero for the next. Yeah.
I'll Photoshop in you winning a Taproot Wizard, which is, like, you definitely won't win that, but you can feel like it for that 10-second walk out video clip.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, so that was crazy, and to see all the hype, and then it came and went. And then it was funny, like, watching the mempool.space fee, it started at zero, or, like, whatever it was, 40 or whatever. I remember seeing tweets of, like, some of the map machines, like, this is all you degens got? Like, this is stupid. You guys are not doing what you should.
Give it a couple minutes.
Like, just wait 5 minutes, and then it just goes to hundreds, and then they add zero, and then I think the height was something like 2,000 sats for me by. I was
over, like, median
21.
Yeah,
that's, let's talk about the runes hype, because, like, super hyped launch. Obviously, we're coming down now. I don't know. I don't even know where to take this. Like,
I think we may have gone through an entire technology adoption cycle. Peak of inflated expectations, trough of disillusionment, and then plateau productivity in, like, a week. This was, like, rapid cycle technology adoption where everybody has been hyped about runes for months. You know, we've been sitting sky high pre-runes projects at sky high valuations. And then when runes hit and everyone saw the trading experience and it was clunky and, you know, people lost half a Bitcoin to a Cenotaph on Unisat and, you know, all of those things happened. And now it's immediately trough of disillusionment, like runes is terrible, the experience is bad, this isn't the Solana meme coin casino that we were promised, and lots of people actually, you know, complaining about runes. And then you have to acknowledge the fact that we have wallets that support runes already, we have marketplaces that support runes already, we have minting tools that support runes already, we have multiple tokens listed on centralized exchanges. I mean, we're, like, already on the plateau of productivity where now we have a good baseline for what runes is. And I don't know. That's my take.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, too, that You know, like if you look at, I wasn't around during the ICO days on Ethereum in 2017, where like everyone was raising off of an idea and like a one paragraph blurb, and that's all it took, and it's to raise millions. It feels like, it's obviously since then, ICO have gotten more, people have wised up to them, they're less susceptible to bullshit. And I feel like the meme coins thing, which I haven't been a part of on other chains, is kind of happening here too, of like the half-life of a meme coin narrative is just getting shorter and shorter. Like, there's a smaller and smaller window to capture the value. And Rune seems like it's that. Like, it was hyped, and then it's closed down, and now we're kind of like, does Dog have utility? Or does somebody build Rune utility tokens? Just the pure narrative thing is like, yeah, you either have a tiny window, or you're going to just be, like, ex-liquidity and holding the bag.
I don't know. I mean, the runes was either a success or a failure or anything in between, depending on what side of the block you were sitting on. I mean, if you were a miner, your average your revenue went up for a couple days. That's the first time we ever had. We saw upwards difficulty adjustment. I believe that was the first upwards difficulty adjustment post-halving ever. Like, that's newsworthy. Now we're back down to all-time low profitability for miners. You know, I will say, like, I think we all share this view here that the particular personality to how runes and fungible tokens will play out on Bitcoin is a cyclical one, where you have pulses of competitive of bidding against each other, which drive these kind of fee revenue spike events. Now, I was really surprised that it was this compressed. Like, I did not expect to, a week later, already be, like, back down to normal fee rates. But here we are. I will say that I think Runes was a success in the, at least from the consideration that, like, nothing critical broke. Yes, Unisat had a whole Cenotaph, like, production issue and was, like, caught, you know, creating bad signatures. But, like, if that was it, wow. I mean, this is now a billion-dollar ecosystem almost overnight without any major critical flaws to just how it works. Remember how ordinals worked. Remember how it took us 6 months to even address the numbering issue, and then basically, you know, 9 to 10 months to actually full circle do the Jubilee and have a consensus around, like, what do inscriptions even look like? So here we are a week later. Doesn't look like we have any critical bugs, which I think that was the thing I was looking at the closest. Like, are there critical bugs across the entire ecosystem? Apparently, it does not appear that there currently are.
Is there any argument that Runes was a failure?
There is amongst people who expected it to be Solana immediately and for everything to be as fungible.
False expectations was the only failure.
Like, almost every failure of anything that's perceived that was, like, it's such a subjective term. Like, failure requires a perspective. And I think most of the time when people are upset in the blockchain realm, it's because they thought something that couldn't be true. And I think in this case, there's no possible launch that would have made the people who are upset by it happy. I don't think anything would have done that. So I don't think it's the fault of Runes. I think Runes have proven to be in some way superior or helpful, or, you know, that they have a seat at the table. And anybody who thinks that it's not Solana, like, there's no Jupiter DEX. There's not any way to do that at the moment. Like, it can't be what it is. It can't be that. And if you want it to be that, go do the other thing for a while and wait for that to be built here. But zero things are established on day one. They can't be. It takes time to do that. Like, even the BRC protocol, it took 6 months for anything to get a $1 billion market cap. We already have tokens that are B now, like today, 5 days after the launch. So, like, what did we think was going to happen that would have been more successful than what already did, right?
Yep.
What could have happened?
I can empathize with the degens who wanted everything to go 1,000x overnight. I get that. But, like, there is going to be another wave. Now that the tooling is in place, people have totally forsaken the ecosystem. There's got to be more. It's just, I don't really know how it'll play out.
I mean, the one claim I've seen that seems the most credible is that the trading experience out the gate is much closer to BRC20 than the opposite. Like, yes, you can chunk down the visibility, but we're still trading in batches, even enough to do this inscribed transfer thing. The UTXO bloat of like the incentive to hold more UTXOs to chunk down your dog, for example. I think that one, we'll see how far developers can push that against the protocol's limitations and op return, but that's the current one that like holds water for me.
Yeah, and I've talked a lot about this, about my own interest in runes, which really isn't because they're another fungible token on Bitcoin, but rather because they are UTXO based, it makes them very extensible onto layer twos, or, you know, sending them to be settled and traded elsewhere with less friction. I think that's very compelling because runes on the L1 are just not really, they're always going to have like a structural issue to trade back and forth. They're always, it's going to be really hard to not have the BRC20 experience.
But I also have to say, does
it even matter? Because we've seen the market does not particularly care whether it's, you know, a UTXO-based protocol or whether it's some kind of like multi-sig bridge to a Merlin chain. The market doesn't really care. The market just wants to trade. So I don't know. I have a personal technical preference, but I don't know if I can predict anything.
I just wanted to point out that I think the benefits, whether people acknowledge it or not or use it more because of these things or not, there are no transfer inscriptions and there are no inscriptions that are just littering everything. And when you want to break things down into new, smaller UTXOs in order to sell them as such, you just send them. You don't have to make an inscription to do so. And then when you list it and delist it, you don't have to re-inscribe to list it again. There are so many individual steps taken out. It's not a single step or a single click yet. And that's what is upsetting people, is that it's just not an analogous trading experience. But it's way more smooth and streamlined than BRC. So you don't have all this BRC trash like the UTXO bloat or whatever, the inscriptions laying all over the place. And the transaction size is, am I wrong about this? Is it not half the size roughly per, let's say, mint? That not 131 VB roughly for a runes mint and about 262 for a BRC mint? Can Bitcoin not chew through half or twice as many transactions per block?
All the transactions up like that. For sure.
Yeah, like significantly by 50%.
It's a little tricky because runes, one transaction equals one mint. So you have all the transaction overhead associated with it. So even though you have a small op return, it has to be a full transaction. With BRC20, you can have the transaction overhead plus you can batch mint 1,000, 2,000, 5,000 in the same transaction. And so with runes, you get the overhead for every single mint. For BRC20, you just get the, you know, whatever it is, the small JSON BRC20 blob as your byte size. And so I haven't actually done the comparison yet. Like if you were going to mint 1,000 tokens, is it better to do one transaction with 1,000 BRC20 mints, or is it better to do 1,000 transactions with 1,000 runes mints? And that's the comparison. That's the comparison you need to make. And I actually don't know which one is better. I'm guessing BRC20 might actually be better in that scenario, just because of the transaction overhead.
But then trading post-mint is lower transaction size because it doesn't require inscriptions, potentially, for runes rather?
The huge unlock is you don't have to inscribe a transfer. So right. Definitely fewer transactions to go to trading. And then in terms of runes is nicer because you can chain 25 together. This is what like the Rune Blaster does from
LIFO FIFO.
Yeah. Is it LIFO or is it LIFO? Is it LIFO FIFO?
I'll ask him. I don't know.
I say LIFO because that's what you say. That's how people pronounce last in, first out.
Yeah.
PC comes along. I think PC intentionally mispronounced people's name.
Okay. So LIFO. Yeah. LIFO FIFO, the Rune Blaster. With CPFP, you can do 25 recursion depth. So that means you can take one big chunk and you can do runes, and then you can use the change and do another runes and use the change and do another rune 25 times. And you can basically use the same runes UTXO and conglomerate or add all of those together across the 25. But with BRC20, obviously you can't do that.
Sure.
But the Mint does just go to your balance, and so BRC20 by default would be aggregating up to your account. They're not separate. You know, when you mint, it just goes to your account. The mint inscription is worthless. And so in a way, BRC20 is the same, where it just takes one transfer to do your whole balance, as long as it's all minted to the same account. So I don't actually know if Runes is lighter on Bitcoin yet.
It'd be fun to watch that play out. I was just digging through individual transactions the other day and seeing that in general, Runes transactions were smaller, but I don't think that's a holistic view of it. That's just piece by piece.
Yeah, I think they're... And some of this is limited by Casey's definition of the Runes protocol. You could probably expand that if you had more opportune space to further allow more expressivity in a multiple output transaction. But that's currently not recognized in his Runes protocol implementation. So,
I had a fun one to bring up. Elok posted something about using the inscription endpoint to make inscriptions aware of the rune balance, which is really exciting. It's an exciting idea to be able to send runes to a UTXO already containing an inscription and have the inscription somehow self-update based on what type of token or the number of them. This is going to be a fun thing to see what people do with it.
Yeah, it's really cool. So Casey originally proposed this idea a few Ordinals coding clubs back, said you can do this. Now it's a matter of how you implement it. LIFO FIFO, aforementioned LIFO FIFO, threw up a PR a couple weeks ago saying, here's an idea we could do. We could reference root ID. And then Elok threw up a PR saying, here's another idea. We could reference the output that the inscription is on, because we already know that. So just getting this conversation going, I think this is one of those things where everybody wants it to happen. Now it's a question of how are we going to implement it.
And this could potentially be one of the biggest unlocks for Runes, is it's natively integrated into the Ordinals protocol. And you could start doing not just like airdropping, like easily airdropping runes to Ordinal inscriptions, but also supercharging inscriptions based on Runes balance. So if you hold your Ordinal in an account that has a Runes balance of X token over 1,000 or whatever, you get a better looking Ordinal or something like that. You just need some kind of runes endpoint, and it's like a recursive endpoint, and now you can supercharge Ordinals with runes. So yeah, definitely crazy exciting things happening with the interplay between the two.
Yeah, and a cool thing here too, from what I understand, is that because you have two independent indexers, you couldn't do this with BRC20 because it was like one, it has a dependency on ORD when runes is separate, so they'll both be running independently, and you can start to play with those levers without, if ORD breaks, runes is still doing the fine kind of thing. Yeah, I think that's interesting. One other thing on the runes and the L2s, because you brought that up for a second, Charlie. I'm like mega hyper turbo bullish on runes as I'm calling it an interoperability token. I don't know what the fuck that means, but it captures it of like, if you look at crypto, everything trades against USDT for the most part. And we've never had a token low enough on the stack like runes that's on the L1 or whatever, close to it, and it can go up to L2s. And all the L2 builders are supporting runes like already. Stacks builders, rootstock, sovereign, non-rootstock, everyone's doing runes as well. So being able to go from an L2 into Rune and then use some DEX that supports Rune and then over to rootstock, like this way of using tokens in that way hasn't existed. And I think it technically, well, not technically, it kind of makes all L2s connected to each other through like maybe two steps of trading that we haven't had before. I'm stupid bullish on that. If you're building something like that, hit me up. I want to invest in you. But in meme coin season, everyone's thinking about it as like degen stuff, but I think the utility of runes in that way is going to be absolutely massive. I can't even tell if I'm just being crazy or if I'm like correct, but I think that's going to be a thing.
I think that makes a lot of sense. I've talked a lot about it, that the future of meme coins is on low friction layers. So whatever implementation technology, meme coin, or even different chain can provide that combination of low friction release and trading and settlement of these things and make it appealing to degens, I think that's, you know, that's a no-brainer. I like that is definitely like the thesis of this cycle, right? You see venture capital writing threads on why meme coins are an investable asset. First of all, what the hell, venture? You guys are insane. Second of all, like, it's very obvious that this is going to continue for another year or so. Like, it's just meme coin season. So now the question is, where is the casino going to be built?
Yep. Okay.
There is the ever-present concern of liquidity fragmentation. This has not been solved in a world of mini L2s, in a world of runes thriving on mini L2s. You still have liquidity fragmentation across your L2s. There's no easy solution here. You have fragmented rune liquidity across all of the L2s, across all the different apps. There's no easy atomic swapping between them. There's no, I mean, people are trying to do things like shared sequencing and other kinds of things, or shared bridging, but it's unsolved. And so I'm perhaps less than the, whatever you said, hyper mega crazy stupid bullish, just because bridging is a pain. Bridging is incredibly painful and liquidity fragmentation. So yeah, we'll see.
Yeah, I think the kicker here is typically bridges. You take a name token and then you present a wraps token on the other side, or that's a one-to-one representation. I think atomic swaps are going to be the big thing here, of like, you'll go from, say you want to go from Sovereign to Alex, so rootstock to stacks. You're in the SOV token, you want to end up in the Alex token. You can go SOV into their Go-Go Power Rangers whatever token on runes, atomic swap, and then use something on runes to go into something that's nicer to play with Alex, and then atomic swap again, runes based Alex token into Alex. Like, that's, it's still fragmentation and it's still annoying. You're going to pay at least two transactions, but to unlock, we haven't seen without having to go to centralized whatever's currently.
Yeah, I mean, you just said two Bitcoin transactions, so now it's like, that's an hour. That's like an hour to bridge between the two ecosystems, like pain, max pain.
At least.
So yeah, sure, you can do it, but do we want to do it? Is that really the end-all be-all for DeFi on Bitcoin, is we're going to go from one fast layer and then pause while we settle a whole bunch of layer one transactions to trustlessly swap to another layer? Like, sure, like, we can do it, but I don't know. I'm hoping for something better. That's why I'm like, yeah, it's interesting, but I'm not hyper mega super fever.
Yeah. Isn't Arbitrum like 14 days or something? Aren't there like even worse options on a faster, more commonly accepted and used chain called Ethereum? Like, aren't some of those even slower?
Let's talk about how some Bitcoin L2s are optimistic. And so with optimistic rollups, generally you have a 7-day withdrawal window anyway. And so now you're going from an optimistic rollup that's trying to settle in some fashion, and then you're bridging, and now you have multiple transactions in line. Like, I don't know. I think it's going to be terrible UX.
We're 15 years into this, and we just like still have such a terrible user experience. What are we doing?
15 years is no time. That is historically no time.
Facebook, 15 years down the road, had kind of developed what it looks like. A lot of like technology in 15 years, especially these days, that's two or three major cycle in generations. And here we are. We still have the scaling and user experience challenge. How do we get this to a billion to 7 billion people? Like, I have no idea.
The blockchain trilemma, it rears its ugly head again, where you can have decentralization and you can have security, but you're not going to get scalability.
Custodial's the way. That's the answer. Just trust Coinbase, bro. It's fine.
I mean, yeah, sacrifice free socialization. Yeah.
Yeah. Which is a natural segue to, you know, being co-opted by the government and risks of custody. Yeah, we got to talk about Samurai Wallet, which I've actually never used. It's a privacy mixing service. You send in your Bitcoin. It does some fancy stuff so it can't be tracked and then send it back to you. So it's a privacy-focused tool mainly. And yeah, my understanding is the Department of Justice took down the domain and arrested the two co-founders. And that's all we currently know. We don't know how much data is in the database, how much is exposed, all of that. Is that the current bleeding edge?
Yeah. I recommended Samurai Wallet to friends for years. I've used it a lot. I even interviewed one of the Samurai guys during the ocean, shindig back in December. I know, so I've talked to many of the Samurai team, a number of the Samurai team in person. They are very, very aggressive publicly. They've just been really, really shitty to a lot of people in Bitcoin, but they're uncompromising privacy advocates. And this is one of those things where you can, you know, if you care about privacy and open networks and government overreach, this is an iconic event where we rally around this and we say Bitcoin needs more privacy advocates. The particular government agencies in this capacity have done something really, really alarming that I want to speak out against. So shout out all the privacy advocates in Bitcoin and other blockchains. This is a really unifying moment. I feel like a lot, like very similar to the Tornado Cash moment on ETH. Like that's one where it doesn't matter what blockchain you're on. This is more of a line in the sand for privacy overall. There is a worry though, because the mixing service required you giving your XPub over. So you have your XPub from which you derive all your public addresses, so they could tell we're on the opposite side of the mix, your coins go. That XPub had to be used if you were not going to use their own Dojo product. You basically had to reveal your XPub. So in this case, depending on how the government seized or surveilled or what Samurai did with those XPubs, you know, the seizing authorities can tell and connect public addresses after the fact if they have a sufficient amount of XPubs. That was a point of criticism prior to this to Samurai, but it's also, I think, really more of a criticism of the fact that Bitcoin is very hard to be private on. A lot of people say, that's great. You know, we don't want criminals, but I say privacy should be something you optionally reveal. Bitcoin should allow that. And right now it's really hard to even if you are an uncompromising privacy advocate, it's really hard to do that on Bitcoin's base layer. So shout out Samurai and shout out other privacy advocates.
Yeah, this one, and Donnie, you were taking notes. I know you got some shit coming up, but
I don't want to lose it, you know.
This one does scare me, because if you look at like Tornado Cash, I was taken down on the ETH side a couple years ago, and like University is kind of the same response, and now we have it on Bitcoin. It is interesting that some of the people have been like, fuck you, Samurai. And I guess it's because of the way they treated some Bitcoiners amongst the community. But it does make me think that maybe I don't think about privacy at all. I just spend my stuff, and if I sell some Bitcoin, I'll just record the tax, whatever. But I wonder if they actually have a better grasp on Bitcoin than we realize when it comes to like chain analysis tools. And that's why they keep coming to these things. They say it's for like tracking money laundering or funding terrorism, but like maybe it throws a decent wrench into privacy and they have a good grasp on it. That's like I have no data, but maybe. And that's why they're trying to take it down, is because they're breaking the stuff they have in the back end, the government watching.
Yeah, I think the one thing I would add is in the U.S., OFAC, which is sanctions compliance, is fairly strict, very, very strict. As a U.S. citizen, you are not allowed to financially transact with sanctioned countries, sanctioned individuals. And in the event that you've done anything like that, there are very strict consequences. And this is like, you know, U.S. law. And so when there are services that are potentially facilitating interactions like that, I don't necessarily view it as an attack on privacy, although in some fashion it is. But specifically in the US, because of the regulatory environment, you almost have to do privacy in like a ZK kind of way. Yeah, it's because your hand's on your arm. I think if you had a mixing service and you had a way to just reveal like maybe country where you're transacting from in a secure way, like I don't think anyone would have a problem with that, assuming that you can avoid sanctions compliance issues and, you know, obey the existing regulatory laws of the land. But when you just do blanket mixing, now there are concerns from the federal OFAC and other sanctions compliance entities.
And do you guys know, was Samurai constructed to be non-custodial? They never held the funds.
They never held the funds.
That's my understanding. And like talking to some founders who, you know, especially on Lightning, like with LSPs and all these kind of things, there's this like money transmitter regulatory aspect where it's like you want to build custodial, but it's a pain. It's a pain in the ass on the regulatory side, for the benefit of if you lean into that mess, you could be like Strike or Cash App, for example. So the working thesis as I've been talking to founders is lean into the difficulty and build non-custodial, but that's even now becoming less clear. That even that's not enough of a shelter or a firewall to protect you if the people on the other side, and you're just in the middle, are doing shit that the government says is not okay. So as an investor, like this is, again, terrible for the investment landscape because it's hard to know what the government's going to do on either side now. Custodial and like, let me come talk to Uncle Gary, or I never touched funds, but you're still not okay. Like, it's just a mess.
That's kind of what I was writing down. Previously, when the DOJ goes after companies, it has been often their excuses that the companies had custody of funds, right? This time they're not doing that. They were leaning in specifically to that Samurai was charging a fee for a service. And they were also leaning into the fact that they were not requiring KYC and had no clear terms, which leads me to the next question of whether or not Sparrow can be looked at as somehow facilitating a service. They don't collect fees. They don't KYC. No clear terms. They don't have custody. I don't know who could be taken down for that or if it even is possible to do that. But it is probably on the government thinks it's scary list. So it's safe on like the no custody, no fees thing. It's not really safe on the no KYC in terms thing. Stripe releasing that you can make crypto payments through Phantom and MetaMask makes me question whether or not Stripe or Phantom and MetaMask or all three are going to be on the chopping block for quite a similar problem, although in very different ways. Are Phantom and MetaMask going to have to enforce KYC to stay in business, or are they all going to go to jail, or what? Like, is custodial debt, or you know what I'm trying to say?
Don't they do...
Yeah, some people say yes. I have no idea yet.
Yeah. I mean, nobody's from the future. Yeah.
Do they do countrywide blocking at MetaMask? Surely they must.
I don't know, because the U.S. can still use it, so I would assume that they don't.
They offload that responsibility onto the dApp and to the front end for the contracts, in my experience. I don't think MetaMask, I don't think the wallet providers do that for the time being. That's like the dApp's responsibility. But again, this is so unclear, especially with the FBI announcement this past week, or yesterday. I personally am not terribly worried about self-custody solutions, but anything that isn't a very clear, like, wallet that does other things, that's a surface area for attack. Like what Bob said, the Lightning service providers, like, to me, that's a very targetable type of business as a money transmitter, although I think it's totally misguided, but it's like, look at what Phoenix Wallet did this morning. Phoenix Wallet, my preferred Lightning wallet, shut down services. They are one of the largest Lightning service providers, or LSPs. This is kind of the thing that the Lightning ecosystem is moving towards anyway. Like 95% of all transactions on Lightning or more are through LSPs. If this actually like proliferates across the other American accessible LSP landscape, that like neuters Americans' access to Lightning. So that's not good.
What about change now and fixed float, things like that, that are not wallet providers in any way? They don't take funds, or maybe they do. I actually don't know where anything goes when you send it to them and then they send it back. Are they on the chopping block too, do you think? Because they're technically mixers of a sort.
No, that out. It's unclear. I mean, like, yeah. I think that's, I mean, the fees thing makes sense. Like, all these services that are building, they're, a lot of them are VC-backed or trying to build a sustainable business. And so you have to get fees somewhere. And if that's one piece where it's like you have to start to police where the payments are going, not just taking your kind of vague in the middle, and that kind of puts you one check mark on the chopping block. There's a wide design space or a wide attack surface there. Like everyone's potentially attackable there.
Is this just humans getting confused that we don't have geographic boundaries anymore? Can this all be boiled down to us just kind of not knowing what to do when there's like, where is the internet? Where is it? Is that it? The governments are like, you can't be nowhere. You got to be somewhere, you know? And then like 60 years from now, everyone's going to be like, no, nothing was ever anywhere, man. Like just live on the internet.
Network state, bro. Yeah, I
seriously though, it's a monkey problem where we're all really confused that all of a sudden it's like things aren't happening in a space. They're happening nowhere or anywhere. I think this
I think it's probably in the death throes of fiat and it's trying to preserve its power. But then, yeah, two is like, because you have these tools that are good at privacy, if the government could track everything, then they would be okay with it. They know that you sent money to him and that to that. They have a big-ass social graph. But because there's been blind spots there, I'm sure that's part of why they're like, I can't control it in the way that you can with cash, for example. Like, credit cards are very policed, and cash, anytime it's over a certain amount, the bank's going to treat you like a villain. Like, what are you buying, bro? You're not buying a Tesla in cash. No, you're not doing that. No one does that. That's weird. You're going to go buy drugs, sir. And it's like, it's my money. So, like, there's all these kind of, like, stopgap things they can do to control people that crypto, when you can move $1 billion for $7 or whatever, it's just such a change in scale. I don't know. They have to. You know, it kind of seems inevitable. I guess the plus side, though, is the bigger enemies you make, and it's good Stripe trading into this, it's going to force regulatory clarity. It's going to have to. There's going to be huge court cases, and they're going to also change how we and shit, like all this stuff that's been just like old and decrepit, that's going to have to change, and it's going to come through the Supreme Court eventually.
I can't wait till Coinbase versus the SEC goes to the Supreme Court and they finally, hopefully, comment on this. You know, the SEC is acting in a way that is unconstitutional for all of these reasons, and we need regulatory clarity, and here's what it is, or here's how we're going to do it. I mean, that's what people want. Quickly going back to the MetaMask. MetaMask is like Sparrow, self-hosted wallet. Anyone in the world can use it. But Infura, the API that everyone uses to get all of your data, that Infura does have to comply with sanctions regulations. And so you do run into some issues if you're in a sanctioned country trying to use certain Ethereum-based products that interact with MetaMask. Like you're going to, I don't know, need to run your own node in order to get the data, in order to transact in some fashion.
Or VPN.
So yeah, APIs, nodes, applications all have to worry about sanctions compliance.
Makes sense. All right, we're coming up on the top of the hour. Do we want to do one more topic?
Because it started late. I'm down.
Because we could do minor centralization, which is one that you've been talking about recently. Charlie, I know you're nerd about mining all day long, but everyone thinks about the lens of mining pools, and now there's like a different attack surface, so I'd love to explore that a little further, give people the alpha so they can stay on top.
Let's talk about Stratum too.
It's funny because a lot of what, you know, remember when, roll the clock back, remember we were talking about Ocean on this show last December. And we were talking about how it was really dumb that they got almost like pigeonholed into having to be anti-ordinals, which I think is a really dumb position to take. the original vision behind Ocean was actually to push back against perceived centralization in the mining ecosystem. And that was actually part of their launch message. That was like the dominant part of their launch message. And I think, and I personally love that angle. I also love this idea they're going to try Stratum V2. Give miners more control of the block template, more private, you know, template submission. But like, you know, it looks like they were directionally right and maybe just didn't execute on some of the narrative capture, because we've seen several researchers, shout out Parker Merritt of Coinmetrics and OXB10C, an independent Bitcoin researcher, as well as Modinaut with mempool.space. Those three guys and possibly more had had various deep dives into miner payout flow, as well as in particular OXB10C did a great analysis on identical block templates that various pools were working off of. In layperson speak, this basically strongly suggests that a certain number of pools are actually the exact same pool, just with different public monikers to the blocks they produce. And so this is really alarming from a Bitcoin standpoint, whether or not you're a hash producer, a competing block producer, a Bitcoin holder or a Bitcoin user, or even if you're a JPEG degen and you want to get your JPEGs into Bitcoin's blockchain. All of these are challenged by block production centralization. I would be very specific and say this is not miner centralization. This is the people who produce the blocks that go onto the blockchain.
Does it mean that they just use the same block template, or does it mean that they're actually the same mining pool in a way?
OXB10C's strong inference was that it is the same mining pool, perhaps even the same node.
So it's just they split up their hash rate publicly based on to conceal how big they actually are?
I would ask you, how do we know that pool A and pool B are different pools? How do we determine which blocks are attributable to which pool? The pools voluntarily sign their names in the Coinbase output. So it's an elective self-reporting mechanism, which is then communicated to the various different analysis tools out there to say this pool has X percent of the hash rate. So
could a mining pool just say 20% of the time that we win a block be this identity, 20% of the time be this identity, and 20% of the time be this? Like, that's possible?
That's possible.
And you wouldn't know because it's just a specific private key, essentially, that's signing for a particular entity, right?
Pretty much. It's
because, yeah. I mean, but isn't there an incentive here then if they are acting as like quasi brands, let's say they're just like shell companies, if you will.
Shell companies, yeah.
Wouldn't it, and you say it's like the ETFs where it's like you have 15 ETFs, but they all go into Coinbase. It's kind of similar, but not exactly the same. But if you want to push back against this like decentralization narrative and make it less of a topic, isn't there an incentive to spin up more and not have VIA and Ant and like the distribution be a little more skewed if it's that easy?
Yeah, certainly that's the incentive. Yeah. This could be a very long deep dive conversation, but those are the two high points. Yes, there is an incentive. We would hope that people, the ecosystem, would recognize this and want to diversify.
Could there be a reorg without us even seeing it? Because it looks like it's coming from four different miners. And thereby, could there have been a reorg?
Yeah.
On that thing that we just didn't know about because it was four different mining companies, technically.
Well, I mean, imagine this scenario. We say, oh, look, Antpool and Binance are competing for this reorg, but they're the same pool.
But I mean, can they technically?
I think there would be a lot of interesting back testing someone else could do.
The other thing I wanted to point out is that Ocean Mining has a merch store, and I'm going to buy some pieces and wear them around, talk like I normally talk, and try to confuse the shit out of
it. Well, so Casey actually pointed out, so this was not as big of a news story at the time, but I will shout out my colleague Will Foxley, who covered the launch of Demand Pool last September, which was actually the first major productized Stratum V2 pool before Ocean. It just was a very, I would describe it as an indie effort compared to Ocean's much more like well-backed, well-executed rollout. So Demand Pool is another Stratum V2 pool run by an acquaintance of mine, Alejandro, Bit Entrepreneur on Twitter. Casey shouted out Demand Pool, and I think that would be a great mining pool to buy some merchandise from.
Love it. This makes you want to get custom merch made that says, like, I mine with Ocean, and I choose the core template, like, on the back, so, like, depending which way you see, like, that would be so good. Just to make
their crew neck is kind of nice, actually. The rest of this stuff is all like golf material that I would never wear, you know, like the golf polo, you know what I'm talking about? Like business people wear.
Yeah.
But the crew neck Ocean sweater is pretty good looking. I think I might order one.
Okay, I guess to close it out then real quick, like if this is true, and it seems like it is, like how do we know it's going in the right direction, that it's being mitigated? Because it also seems now that once this is known, they could just change their kind of node infra and go back into hiding. Like they've been found out. Now we got to change two steps of our process and we're back to the same process. And we would never know.
Correct.
Damn it, Charlie.
Yeah. Here's your big black pill for the day. You had a great week with Samurai, but there you go.
I guess to leave people on with, like, we can, if you want to go learn more about this, like, I've seen Matt Carollo be vocal about this. Who are the best people that are, like, vocalizing this that we should go look at if we want to be, like, at the edge?
There are not a lot of people who I would say are offering solutions. There's only recently some people who are talking about it. I myself talk about it. I do want to be very delicate and tactful about it, given that I do come from the mining ecosystem. Obviously going to shill block space, but I'm going to point to Mononaut in particular at mempool.space, who watches blocks come in really closely. OXB10C, whatever the rest of the handle is, that's one on Twitter you should watch. They're a Bitcoin researcher, very underfollowed. I think there will be more people because this has still been a very, very insular kind of nuclear topic. I would hope that in 2 to 3 months, there's a lot better public discussion on this topic. Matt Carollo, as legendary as he is, he has what I think is an insane and ridiculous idea to change the hashing algorithm. I think he's very misfiring here, and I think he's really good at identifying some of the problem. I think he could be very misguided as to like how to respond to it. This is my opinion, but Matt Carollo is, wants Bitcoin to succeed. I'm gonna shout another fellow Bitcoin maxi, Marty Bent and Matt Odell, like OG, long time, very hardcore, literal laser eyed Bitcoin maximalists who are, I use the word uncompromising a lot. They're very uncompromising in their opinions and strong adherence to like promoting Bitcoin's decentralization. So Tales from the Crypt is a good podcast to listen to whenever they do more treatment on this subject.
Love it. I think that's a great place to call it. Great episode as always, Jarvin. Thank you. It's gone up. We playing the long game to the black rock chains with the racks paid off from the blockchain. Going up high octane, so we up in here like pomade. Making big noise, big money, go play with your kid toys. You funny, I'm counting my Bitcoin. We up and we been gone. It's gone. Planned it out and we did this purposefully. Panning out like the kitchen currently. It's like surgery. Way it's earning me. A nurse's salary for cryptocurrency. I'm on a vacay drinking coconuts while wearing polka dots. This ain't no hocus pocus. Listen up and learn. It's gone up.